You may or may not have ever heard the name of an artist by the name of Albrecht Dürer. Lived in the early 1500s. But whether you recognize his name or not, you would certainly recognize his work should you see it. And of all the work he did, the one piece of work that's the most famous of all, he entitled Hands. But in all the centuries since he first made that woodcut that was used as a block to ink and then print on paper with, so it was a woodblock print, it's always been called the praying hands, the gnarled, worn hands of someone in prayer. I've read two different versions of the story. It only differs in some of the minor details. So I sort of combined those two and assumed that if I take sort of the least common denominator of those two stories, we have the essence of the story. Albrecht was one of 18 children born in his family. And while his father was a craftsman, there was no way he could make enough money to more than just barely feed a family of that size. He lived in Germany, and as the children grew older, two of those children, brothers, Albrecht and his slightly older brother, Albert, showed a great propensity towards the arts, the ability to be artistic. And yet there was no way the family would ever be able to send either one of them off to the big university where they could get formal training in the arts. And as they reached the age where it was time for them to go to work to help provide for the family, Albert, the older brother, and Albrecht hatched a plan. And the plan was this, that one of them would go to work in the mines there of their town and take part of his earnings to support the family and take the other part to send his brother off to school for 4 years. And then after he was finished at university and perhaps had established himself as an artist, then perhaps he would be able to make enough money from his art then to pay to have the other brother go to school. Well, they chose some means. It's not exactly clear as to which one would go to school first. And Albrecht won. He would get to go to school, and Albert went down and got a job at the mines and started helping support the family and made it possible for Albrecht to go to school. Well, after the 4 years, and he went ahead and distinguished himself at university and right away started having some demand for his art. He was especially talented at that. After a number of years, he came back home, and at one of the family get-togethers, everyone was happy to have Albrecht back home again, and he was happy to be back home because now he was ready to announce to his family and to his brother Albert that he was ready to start letting Albert go to school, and he would help support him. But when he got home, that wasn't possible. Albert's hands had been crushed in accidents at the mines. And one hand now was arthritic, and both of them were so stiff and worn from the hard work that he would never be an artist. And so in honor of his brother, Albrecht made that woodcut of his brother praying. And that's been honored, of course, not just in the Christian community, but all around the world ever since. The influence and power of the Bible and of Christ in the lives of people and in the culture and societies of our world is just beyond measure. We've been talking about what if Jesus had never been born and what if the Bible had never been written. And you know, there's a million stories that could be told of different people who were changed or touched, were different because of that. I read somewhere, and I don't remember the exact numbers, but I think these are pretty close. They surveyed a number of chief executives and high executives in American business. this was just within the last decade, I think, about what had been the most influential book in their lives. To what would, if there were just one book they picked out, what one book would they point to that they would say had influenced their life the most toward the success they had had? Now, there's been a lot of, you know, in the business world, a lot of pretty good books, you know, whether they're written by Zig Ziglar or this fellow out in Utah that writes, can't remember his name at the moment, but Seven Habits of various kinds and so forth. But the number one book named by these men, some 25% of them named the Bible. Many other books were named, but the book that came in second place, only 2% of them named it. And all the other books, less than that. That's how great a difference there was in their mind. 25% of them said the Bible, no other book ever even came close. And the Bible has impacted our world just that way, not just in chief executives, but in every part, every strata, and every generation of the world's culture where it has had the chance to go. And we've already looked at some of that. The Jesus and the Bible's emphasis on the value of human life, the emphasis on compassion and caring for other people, the influence on the laws and the governments of our world. And even last week, I believe, at least it was my intention, to talk about how that the spread of the gospel and the advancing of the Bible had actually advanced culture and civilization and language into parts of the world where it had never gone before. Many primitive cultures in our world over the centuries have gotten a written language for the first time simply because those who were bringing the gospel wanted them to be able to read the Bible. And so they would help them create a written language and then give them the Bible in that written language. And gradually that, of course, meant that other kind of education and knowledge could come into those cultures as well. Tonight I want to talk a little bit about how the Bible and Jesus, the knowledge of Jesus, has had such a profound influence upon the arts and literature of our world. Now, we don't talk very much about arts and literature in the church. Even those of us, maybe I should say, even those of you who are artistic in some way, you don't usually think of your artistic talent as being something the church particularly takes advantage of. And I'm not here to suggest a solution to that dilemma. But the church as a whole over the generations hasn't had that problem. It does seem that right now that is a problem in our culture in this generation. But if we look back through history and we look where the gospel has gone and we look where the Bible has gone, we see that there has been a joining of art of all kinds and the gospel. And literature and the gospel. And that the result of that has been fantastic. It has produced the world's greatest literature. It has produced the world's greatest art. And while some may say, out of some desire to be fair and balanced or whatever they want to call it, they will say, well, what about all these cultures that the Bible hasn't been there and the gospel hasn't been there? Yes, they've produced art. Yes, they've produced literature. But I think you'd be hard-pressed to go to any major university, almost anywhere in the world, and say, what's the greatest literature and what's the greatest art that the world has ever produced? You'd find very little of it would come from those cultures. That's just how profound the effect has been. And so think with me a little bit about some of those. One of the first things that came into my mind is the cathedrals in Europe. They then, in turn, have helped shape architecture throughout at least the Western world. Great structures that Christians built in order to express in some way their respect and honor of God and their desire to worship Him began early. Even while it was still illegal to be a Christian, Christians were already in some areas building church buildings. Now, they might not have been fancy by today's standards, but just the fact that they felt so compelled to do that. And then once Christianity became legal in the Roman Empire, starting in 313 A.D., quickly, magnificent structures started to be built. And whether I personally would agree with whether that was the best way for the church of that time to use its resources. For them, it was an expression of their faith. And then, of course, that all got into full swing during what we call the Middle Ages, starting around AD 1000 up to about 1400. And so you had these great, magnificent structures. Not only were they the epitome of architecture of their time, by and large, they still are today, 1,000 years later. And, you know, we've heard the names of some of them. Some of them actually have the name Cathedral. Others, like St. Peter's Church in Rome, are all part of that same great urge by those believers to express their faith through architecture. Some of them were Roman Catholic, some of them were Anglican, some of them were Eastern Orthodox. And so we have St. Peter's in St. Peter's Square. We have Notre Dame. We have the Cathedral of Canterbury, the Cathedral at Worms, the Cathedral of Toledo in Spain, as well as the Sagrada Familia in Barcelona, which I've only seen in pictures, but it's just one of the most amazing structures I've ever seen, and yet was built hundreds and hundreds of years ago without any of the modern tools of computers and high-powered equipment and so forth and machinery that exist today. And even after numerous regional wars and two great world wars, the vast majority of those structures still stand. I don't think that's because necessarily God has protected them, though I wouldn't rule that out. But I think more because they were so well built. And they were the best built structures of their time. Some of them taking as long as 200 years. And 6 or 7 generations of craftsmen to build from beginning to end. And yet when you go inside, so many of them are laid out in the shape of a cross. With an altar upon which a representation of the body and the blood of Christ is honored. And a place where people can stand and sing. And a place where people can pray. And a place where someone can stand and present the gospel to those who are present. Their very architecture confesses the fundamentals of the gospel and of faith. Then there's music. Another one of those areas that I can only speak from as an outside observer, not as an ardent practitioner. And yet music has been so greatly influenced by the Christian culture and the Christian view and the Bible. One of the great innovations, I understand, in the early centuries came as a result of a pope. Pope Gregory formalized and advanced what was called at that time the Gregorian chant. What little bit of music history I know, some have said that the Gregorian chant was the first advancement in music since the beginning of time. It was the first major step forward in music. Since the beginning of recorded history, it fundamentally changed people's view of music and how music was done. And that was followed soon after by the introduction of multi-part, or we would call it four-part harmony, where music would be sung according to people's different voices, bass or tenor or alto or whatever the other one is, soprano. I can read lips. The introduction of choirs, and though we personally find that not necessarily consistent with what we read in the New Testament, nevertheless, the whole idea of a choir, this idea where there'd be a specialized group of people who would sing together, of course, that has greatly then influenced all kinds of other music that's not sacred. Over the centuries since that time, singing groups of all kinds, the chorales, the introduction of handwritten, and then later, when hundreds of years later, when printing was invented, the printing of music, music scores, song books, hymn books, right along with some of the very earliest copies of the manuscripts of the New Testament itself are books that were handwritten that contained the words to the hymns that the early Christians sang. And then we hit that period of time, sort of the the flowering of all things in the 1500s and the 1600s and in there. And so we start recognizing the names of people like Johann Sebastian Bach, who was an ardent Christian, and almost all of his music was strictly religious and for the purpose of glorifying and praising God. George Frederick Handel, Antonio Vivaldi, who was actually a priest, but because of he suffered from severe asthma, I seem to have heard one time, he was actually dismissed from public service as a priest, and he devoted the rest of his life to writing the music of the church. And even men who, in other ways in their lives, were not particularly outstanding as believers, like Beethoven, nevertheless produced such magnificent, beautiful church music. And much of this laid the foundation for all modern Western music. And we move on into the more recent time with probably the greatest songwriters of the last 500 years, the Wesley brothers, John and Charles Wesley. Their music just touched a chord in all of Western culture, so much so that even now, when fellows bring back videos or recordings from other parts of the world, they come back to Sunset and they've been off in Africa, or they've been off in Indonesia, or they've been off in India, and they come back and they've got video of the saints and that congregation there singing. I don't recognize the song, but I do recognize the song. Even though it's been translated into Hindi or Farsi or one of the Indonesian languages or one of the African languages, it's still hymns like we sing. And even usually the same music, the same notation, notes sung along with it. That has had a, you know, that is a foundation upon what Western culture has been built, is the music of the church. And then beyond just music itself is art of all kinds. Now, I really can't speak to that. I really like that story about Albert Durer and the praying hands, which he's best known for, but he was one of the great artists of his day, living in the late 1400s, early 1500s, and he produced great sets of artwork. He produced 16 woodcuts, great pieces of art about the apocalypse, the revelation. 7 on the Passion of Christ, 11 on the Holy Family, and 17 on the life of the Virgin Mary, and many others in addition to that that are widely recognized. Then there's Michelangelo with his sculpture, David, Moses, the Pietà, which is the, you know, Christ taken down off the cross, being held in the arms of Mary. Or his paintings on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. Raphael, another great artist, lived during the same period of time as Michelangelo, known almost exclusively for his Christian artwork, produced hundreds and hundreds of great pieces of art. I understand over 200 just on the Virgin Mary. Leonardo da Vinci, slightly out on the edge of the Christian community. In some ways, some of his beliefs were a little at odds with the New Testament, but still a part of the Christian community, is painting The Last Supper or Madonna and Child or The Adoration of the Magi, Rembrandt, and goes on and on. And then we start moving into more modern artists, the same thing. So many of them have produced great art that then has become the basis for inspiration of those who are producing totally non-religious art. And yet they learned from these great masters who wanted to take the gift God had given them of being artists or sculptors or whatever it was, and in one way or another to present the gospel or the message of the Bible to the people of their time. And then literature, the written word. And even before the word was in a printed form, it was handwritten. The Bible itself, of course, has continued to be the most published and best-sold book of all time, but it has been quoted and has inspired stories and themes and all sorts of other writings and books over the years. Dante, Chaucer, some of these fellows I haven't even encountered since early high school in my English literature or world literature classes. John Donne, Shakespeare. I've run across a couple of different books that are written just on the influence of the Bible on Shakespeare. So many of his themes and his great plays are actually sort of allegories of lessons out of the Bible. Fyodor Dostoevsky at the end of the 1800s, a great novelist, John Bunyan, the King James Version Bible. There's probably no single version of the Bible that has influenced more Western culture than the King James Version of the Bible itself. John Milton, Charles Dickens, and you may not even know that the very last book that Charles Dickens wrote shortly before his death, he died certainly before he intended to and while he was fairly young, but was a Bible story book for his children entitled The Life of Our Lord. He wanted to make sure his children grew up knowing the story of the gospel. Alfred Lord Tennyson, Leo Tolstoy, Hans Christian Andersen, T.S. Eliot, C.S. Lewis, J.R.R. Tolkien, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, and again, the list just goes on and on. And the writings that they have written, many of their writings are listed among the great writings of Western literature. And they all were not only influenced by the gospel and the Christian faith and by the Bible, but they most often wrote on Christian themes. And then a latecomer to the arts, I guess you could say, is theater, modern theater, especially the movies. And I don't know if you realize it or not, perhaps you did, that this weekend was released the second movie in the series on The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, a fantasy set of stories based on Christian underlying story by C.S. Lewis. Very interesting. The first one that came out a year or so ago as a part of the Chronicles of Narnia, and I guess the first one was what actually The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, where you have the children go through the wardrobe and end up in another world and meet the lion and so forth. And now the second one came out, I guess Thursday it was released, The Prince Caspian, which picks up 1,300 years later in the story and is carrying along the same theme. And it's number one at the box office, and why wouldn't it be? It's not only a great story in and of itself, but it has this great Christian theme underneath it. If any of you have seen the first one, surely you recognize that the lion was the Lord Jesus Christ. That was the whole point. That's why he died. He was giving his life so someone else could be saved. And that's what C.S. Lewis was trying to say in that great fantasy. But not just him. One of his very best friends wrote another set of books that were quite popular in their day. And you might have recognized them. They're called The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien, another devout believer who wrote this set of stories about a fantastical world, but with the underlying Christian theme about all of it. And as many times as I've watched the movie, I still get choked up every time at the end of the third one, when at last the victory's won and the king is going to be crowned and he's going to be married to his bride. And of course, that's Christ and the church. That was the whole point with Tolkien. And that's what he wanted to present in this allegorical kind of way in the whole story. But even other movies, Ben-Hur. You know, these are a bunch of movies that all have Academy Awards and all those kind of things about them. I guess Ben-Hur probably won more Academy Awards than any other movie that's ever been made in its day. It's a Wonderful Life, Jimmy Stewart. The Sound of Music. Isn't she a nun? Isn't that the whole thing that's going on there? A Man for All Seasons. Chariots of Fire. Won the Oscar that year for Best Picture. The story of a devout minister of the gospel in the Presbyterian Church who not only was a missionary in China, but also could run and won at the Olympics in 1924. The greatest story ever told, the life of Christ. The Ten Commandments, Moses and the Israelites leaving Egypt. More recently, The Passion of the Christ by Mel Gibson. Panned by everybody, criticized by everybody. Over $500 million at the box office. And we've already mentioned The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and the Lord of the Rings trilogy and so many more that could be mentioned. What I'm saying by all of this is that not only has the Bible and the stories of the Bible and the Christ of the Bible influenced all of these things, there's nothing else that has done any of this. At first, people might want to just sort of dismiss the fact that the Bible has had this profound an influence on architecture and art and music and literature and the movies. I might want to just dismiss it. Well, so what? And I say, show me another book that has even had 1/1000th of the influence. Show me any other man that only 1/100th as many movies and books and stories and so forth have been written about. You won't find them. No other book. No other man. Is that just a fluke of history? Is that just some kind of an accident? Is this just fortuitous circumstances? Not to believers. It means there's something so very uniquely different about both this person, Jesus, and this book that is the book of books that talk about him and God's plan for mankind that has found this place uniquely in the hearts and minds of people for the last 2,000 years, and I'm convinced will continue to until this world comes to an end. Because it speaks of something that nothing else can address with any kind of authority. That's God's love for and plan for mankind. Hopefully next week I'll talk about something that many people might find rather sound contradictory at first, and that is the influence of Jesus and the Bible on science. On science. We shared a few weeks ago in a different set of lessons how that still, as much as is made over how science doesn't believe in the Bible and scientists say you don't need God anymore to explain everything, 40% of scientists with PhDs believe there's a God. Another 15% says there may be, we're just not sure. The 45% remaining says, no, we don't think there is. The Bible has had a profound influence upon science and scientists. And you'll recognize the names of many of these great people we'll talk about next week. But Mark has an invitation song for us.